committee to order. I'll let the record note that it is March 17th and it's 1 p.m. On today's agenda, we have a couple of items. The first is a presentation by MnDOT on their flood preparations. And with us, I believe, Bernie Arsenault is on the agenda. Mr. Arsenault, welcome to the committee, and we appreciate your briefing on the plans that you have and the preparations that you made, considering the beautiful weather that we have outside and the snow melt, certainly, that is going on and the concerns that are being raised across the state of Minnesota about flooding. It would be just good for us as a committee to know what your plans are and what you have done in the past to mitigate some of the flooding issues out there. So, appreciate you being here, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We are here to share some of the things that we've been doing in preparation for the what seemed to be certain flooding that will occur in the state. It is a beautiful day out there. Unfortunately, that doesn't help us with the flood situation, although there is some cooler weather coming along that hopefully will slow down this melt a little bit.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Perry.
Mr. Arsenault, are you saying that you would like winter to continue? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Mr. Arsenault, you trust Senator Perry to come up with his
answer. Mr. Chair, Senator Perry, personally, I love summer, but for the flooding condition, I'm being a team player. I have with me, by the way, Mr. Chair and members, Gary Freed, our emergency management person at the department, and he will be doing a lot of work in coordinating the activities that are going on over the next several weeks relative to the flooding. The first slide here, I just want to talk generally about the state as a whole and where we see that there will be, or we're preparing for the potential of flooding. This is not new to us in Minnesota, as you all know. We've got quite a bit of experience in addressing the flooding that does occur, and this time we are on high alert because of the imminent nature of the floods this spring. But you can see generally up on the in the northwest part of the state, the Red River Valley there, that is a we have quite regularly the flooding that occurs up there. Then if you go down south on the western side of the state, you can follow the Minnesota River all the way down to Mankato and then back up into the metro area. And some of the flooding that we see is quite common along that river. And then also we've got the Mississippi River and the impacts that the high water will have on that area as well. I show this to just recognize that we do see the entire state, and we look at it in all districts that have any potential for flooding are going through many of the things that I'll be talking about this afternoon. I will be focusing in quite a bit of detail on a couple of areas, and that's to give you some level of confidence that we are indeed looking at all aspects of this. What I'm not going to talk about every location, but I'm going to give you hopefully a flavor of the work that we're doing in preparation for these floods. The pre-flood planning that goes on, as I mentioned earlier, we have several floods, several pretty serious floods in this state over the past. And prior to those floods and after those floods, we get together and we talk about what we want to be prepared for. And then after the flooding has occurred and the event is coming to a close, we get back again together and talk about what we could have done differently to be better are more efficient at responding to it and better prepared to handle the next flood. And we actually had a workshop last fall after that flooding, and we have again had a workshop for MnDOT folks this spring. We look at things like contact lists, checklists, what is it we need to do, how are we going to administer and coordinate and inventory the different events that are occurring around the state. We look at our incident command structure so that we're properly prepared to respond and provide information. We recognize that a big need during these types of events is to provide information, and we're going to be prepared to do that. And then, again, part of this pre-flood planning is to look at what are those gaps that we missed the last time through. We have trained about 20 individuals for the Emergency Operations Center, and that will be staffed probably 24 hours when we get deep into this event. We anticipate, and working with our partners at DPS and the Emergency Center, we're looking at potentially opening that around the 28th. So this is approaching very quickly for us. Each of our districts then has a structure within that to manage the activities related to the flooding. We have our district emergency operations centers, and then we always are able to contact someone in that district to get updated information or to make any particular request or other contact that would be necessary. We also have teams that are getting together that are ready to go out post-flood to determine what the damage is, begin to look at the cost of those, develop estimates for that work. We have, of course, there's a lot of work to be done with the FEMA and the emergency response activities afterwards for the funding piece. So we're looking at those procedures and making sure that we're prepared by inventorying the proper things and by documenting those things that are necessary for us to streamline the efforts at receiving the funding back. We are currently working with State Patrol to make sure that we have proper staffing levels in the areas where we expect these floods. It's important to have the additional support in those areas in terms of road closures and other needs that these floods bring. We're also looking, and this is where a lot of our work is occurring right now, we're looking at at-risk roads and bridges, and if we think they're going to close, what are the detour routes? We're getting information out early. We're setting up this website through on our front page of our MnDOT website. We will have updated information. We're going out, and you know, a lot of the bridges that are covered, the piers are covered with water right now, river bridges. We're making sure that we have a good sense of the structural situation as it exists, and then we'll be out there looking after the storm too to manage that. We're staging equipment, putting it out across the state so that we can act quickly. We're using this time now during regular hours to be prepared, and we can actually get to a point where when we know that flood is going to occur within a day or two, we can get out there and do the final activities. We're also mapping, making sure that we have appropriate GIS mapping of the roads that are going to be affected. This is a great tool during the flooding to share information about what's going on. We're working with the Army at the airport to dike off certain areas. I mean, there's a lot of both sandbags and dikes that we utilize our Type 3 Jersey barrier for, and we can hold back some water, and that will happen at the St. Paul Airport.
Senator Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How far along is the protection at the airport at this point, and what level of water will your current estimates for protection be overcome?
Mr. Arsenal?
I mean, how high can it be and still protect the St. Paul Airport?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rust, in terms of those specifics, I know we can get that for you. I know it's also different, of course, across the state.
Right. Yeah, I'm concerned about the airport. That
information. Chairman, Senator, the St. Paul Airport is currently has a levee wall to take in the 1965 flood levels to be prepared to see those levels. The flood that we're looking at now has a 25% chance of being over the 1965 levels. Now, I don't know exactly what the foot height of that flood would be, but
Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind. So let's say it's a worst-case scenario. What ad hoc steps do you take once you see it rising beyond the 65 level of protection, and how quickly can you act to protect the integrity of the airport if you see it's going? I mean, how far in advance you say, oh, wow, you know, it hasn't crested yet. It's going to be above that. How much time do you need? I'm just curious.
Chairman, Senator, the National Guard is there now, and they're putting up HESCO barriers around their aviation support building. I believe that if it goes over the levee walls, they're going to protect as many buildings as possible, and all flights will come out of a different airport. They'll just let it flood. So they're putting up barricades now or flood protection now, and if it was going to be close, they could add to that to a point, but at some point, if it kept going,
they just let it flood.
They would have to.
And just use some of the other reliever airports or MSP or something?
Yes.
Where would they go? Would they use other reliever airports, Mr. Chairman?
I'm not sure I heard which airport it was, but I don't recall.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest.
My name is Chris Roy. I'm the Director of Aeronautics for the state, Minnesota Department of Transportation. And that's exactly what would end up happening is most of the operators that are out of St. Paul Airport, they would go to one of the relievers, whether it be Anoka or possibly South St. Paul. Some of them might go to Flying Cloud or MSP. The Air National Guard would relocate their equipment as they could as well.
Okay.
As far as the actual flood preparations right now, the flood wall is going in everywhere other than on the primary runway. The primary runway and that flood protection will go in either this weekend or early part of next week, at which time they'll actually have to close that runway for about a day or so until they can restripe it, and then they can continue to reutilize that shortened primary runway up until such time as the flood would, if it does indeed come up over top that flood protection.
Senator Rust?
Are you concerned that we're having now, it looks like, I don't know what weather is for the rest of the weekend, but we are having some very warm days, relatively speaking, for melting, that the rise of the rivers will accelerate faster than what you have previously anticipated, or is the rise of the rivers on schedule in terms of how you're looking at the weather and the meteorologists and the advice that they're giving you, et cetera?
Mr. Roy?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rust, you know, we're monitoring several different outlets of the information that you know, in terms of how the flooding will occur, and we are trying to be as nimble as possible in adjusting for that. But I think when we talk about preparing, and there's some slides ahead that we'll talk about getting out there and setting up some of these dike systems halfway, it would be difficult for us to go beyond that. So we'll go out. For example, we use Jersey barriers. That gives you 32, 34 inches of additional coverage. It would be difficult in those cases to add any additional height. In other cases, though, we are exploring different types of diking technology that has higher levels than the Jersey barrier, and that it's stackable. It's very expensive, though, and so we're being careful. We haven't used it before, but we're looking at those types of things so that we can get out there in some of these critical areas. But again, that water adds a tremendous amount of pressure to those walls. You can't go extremely high with those.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I've been told, I don't know if it's true or not, that part of the situation at the airport is water table issues. Is that true, or is it all about river overflow, or is anything coming up, percolating up out of the ground?
Chair.
Mr. Roy.
Chairman, Senator Dibble, primarily what's happening is the level of the river is what's driving the forces there. What happened last spring was actually because the river was high, the ground got saturated, and there was some water that percolated through the ground back up onto the airfield. The airport and MAC have taken precautions to try to eliminate that, and they do that through pumping the water that does seep up back through the ground, back over the dike wall, and back into the river. But most of it is really caused by just the water level being high and saturated in the ground.
Thank you. Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Roy, so following with the questioning, so should the airport flood and then recede, approximately how long will it take for the airport to again be usable? Will it be midsummer? How long will the process take once the waters do recede?
Mr. Roy?
Chair and Senator, I'm not exactly sure of that answer. The example I can use is last spring when we had flooding and it did not overtop that dike wall. The operations at the airport continued throughout. I mean, they were able to do just about everything that they can now, the exception being they operate on one runway and that runway is of a shorter length. Now, if it should overtop, I think we'd be into a different situation and MAC would have to be it would be the better agency to answer that question.
Okay, thank you, and you can proceed.
Good job.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members, continuing with some of the things that we're doing, we are working very closely with the local road authorities and other agencies, making sure that we're addressing needs, working together to be as efficient as possible. We're going into this with a intent to keep all possible roads open. So we're diking where we can. We're doing other solutions where we can in an effort to keep as many roadways open as possible. Talked a little bit already about the stockpiling and staging of materials so that we're able to move in there very quickly and set things up to manage the flooding. And we're also looking at traffic patterns. We are certainly well aware that when we close key corridors in this area or anywhere across the state, traffic has to find a place to go, and so we prepare for that by looking at both history and other things and making sure that we're appropriately providing where we can some additional correction or change to help that traffic. Oftentimes it involves either adding a temporary signal or modifying signal timing or closing off some movements on different corridors to effect a better flow of mainline traffic. I mentioned earlier we're also pursuing this new dike system technology. It looks like it can help us with some of the questions we talked about earlier. It's very expensive, but we're looking at that because clearly if we can get out there and keep a road open, it could have a major impact. The other thing I referenced a little bit earlier as well is it's really important for us to understand the impact that these floods have on our structures. So we go out there, we do a really intensive inventory prior to the flood, and we're right back out there after. In some cases, we're out there putting riprap around piers and things. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. We are making sure that we've got the proper people in place, and we're ready, again, to be nimble and able to react quickly. These teams we talked about earlier, and again, it's just critical that we're able to track the costs that are out there, and also we're able to be efficient in how we make decisions along the way as this flooding occurs. As you've all recognized already, we don't know exactly what's going to happen here, and we are certain that there will be surprises along the way, but we believe that we're in a position to be able to react to those and move forward in a very responsible manner. We're also working with the Homeland Security Emergency Management. They're leaders in this effort, especially with the local folks. We're working with the FHWA. Again, relative to the weather, we're having a quick thaw, it appears, right now, and that sometimes leads to this ice jamming, and that can cause really significant problems, even if it's on a stretch of a river that begins to act as a dam for the water trying to get through. but also something that we're keenly aware of is that debris and ice can be up against our bridges, and we need to be very careful when that happens that there's not structural impacts to that.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Arsenault, as we're talking about that, an issue when Senator DeKreif and I were down in Mankato for the governor's flood preparation, one of the concerns that we heard down there was the lack of decision-making. And I say this because there were key communities in my Senate district who through the fall after the fall flood and through the early parts of the winter were trying to get decisions made on clearing the debris that had accumulated, fully knowing that if they couldn't get this debris moved by the spring thaw, that they were going to have ancillary flooding in areas that probably wouldn't had the debris been gone. So when you have this debris on your bridges, up against your bridges, can you just go ahead and clear it, or do you have to go through a process that for some communities seemingly is way too long to get the okay to clear this?
Mr. Arsenault.
Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, I'm not exactly sure I'm not at all sure of the situation that you're describing, but I do know that when debris or other things are bumping up against our bridges or are impacting our infrastructure in ways that might be harmful, I'm not aware of anything that would prevent us from doing that other than safety. I mean, some of you have probably been out when these flooding situations occur, and that water is very, very dangerous, and we have to be very careful about how we go out there. So safety would be our first priority, but then the structural impacts and the impacts of that debris are going to be a priority for us to deal with. Subsequent to the flood, then we would have to prioritize and manage both our normal maintenance operations and activities along with, you know, follow-up to the floods.
Just follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So what you're saying, then, it is your crew that goes out there. You take the initiative based on the amount of debris that would be up against the bridge. So your department goes out and just takes care of it.
Mr. Arsenault?
Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, when it involves the trunk highway, that's true. And beyond that, there is some, I'm sure, cases where the local road authority and MnDOT work together to get some things done, but we would have that authority on our own trunk highway system.
All right, thank you.
Senator DeKreif.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Arsenault, like Senator Perry mentioned, I was down in Mankato with him, meeting with the governor. And after this meeting, what I did is I went to I live in Le County. I went to my Le County emergency manager, and I asked her to give me an update, a report on what levels the river could reach and what impact each different level would have on each of the cities along the Minnesota River that runs north from Mankato up toward the metro area. And she informed me that she couldn't give me that, and I asked why, and she said, because we don't have gauges. And I said, so it's never flooded before? You don't need gauges? And she goes, well, we need them. But there used to be one that MSU and Mankato used to monitor that is no longer working. So right now we're flying blind. And I found that unacceptable. So I sent a letter last night asking former Senator, but now Southern Regional Director of the DNR, Denny Fredrickson, to help out to put up some temporary, if we could, possibly even on some bridge overpasses. The county management director advised me on what overpasses or what road crossings we might be able to look at as possibilities, and I hope Mr. Fredrickson is working on that now. I'm going to be there myself at 1 o'clock tomorrow in Henderson. If they're not up, I want to find some way to get some kind of a temporary monitoring device up at least two crossings. Can you help with that?
Mr. Arsenault.
Mr. Chair and Senator DeKreif, I am aware that that we have acknowledged that some additional measuring needs to be done along these rivers, and I know that we're taking some action in regard to that, although I'm not prepared here to share that. We can get you that. In terms of the request to help do that, I would defer to our operations folks. I don't, as I sit here right now, I don't see a reason why we couldn't help do that.
Okay, I like the fact. I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like the fact that you said you're nimble, because right now I think we're in a critical situation that before this river starts rising, we better have some monitoring devices so we can warn these towns before they get in a critical situation. So I do look forward to your help on this.
Mr. Chair and Senator DeKreif, we'll contact you and talk a little bit more about that.
Thank you.
As I mentioned, Mr. Chair and members, as I mentioned earlier, communications is essential. It's not only essential for the public, but it's also essential for within our agency to coordinate things. We are developing, and this is one of the areas that we've improved upon over the past several years, is our central office communication plan, our decision-making, our coordination within the agency, and this then helps us provide additional information to the public and helps us be transparent about how we're approaching this. We have a local government liaison that's working with the local governments. Mr. Freed Carey is doing a lot of this coordination and administration. There is a 24-hour point of contact for each district. We know how things change throughout this, and we've also got the Allied Radio Matrix for Emergency Response 800 megahertz system in place, and that has been in place for a while. We're continuing to grow that program, but it's really helping us to coordinate with local governments. So we just want to go through some examples here and some things that, again, as I mentioned at the front end of this, we want to talk a little bit about, or actually in quite amount of detail in some areas, and just to give you a flavor for what it is that we're trying to do here. So I'm going to go through a series of layouts showing some of the impacts that we anticipate. This is Trunk Highway 25 near Belle Plaine. This is an area that we believe through diking we can keep 25 open. And so we're out there staging that work right now. That becomes a really key river crossing when we have to close Trunk Highway 41 and Trunk Highway 101. So you've got this as the other bookend to the 169 crossing. Here's the closure limits for Trunk Highway 41, just to the north or west of Trunk Highway 169, right near Chaska. We expect that this will close. We have set up these limits based on our history and understanding of traffic and local need there. Moving along the river, Trunk Highway 101, this is the area where we have those signs along the road that show the 1965 flooding. We do anticipate that this will flood again, and we're intending to close it when the waters reach that level. Moving further along, we come to the Trunk Highway 169 Bloomington Ferry Bridge, and also Trunk Highway 13, Old 101, how that fits through there. Now, this is an area that, again, we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but we do expect that the old Trunk Highway 101 area will flood. We have a planned detour route using 13 and 18 and County Road 42 to bypass that flooding area. However, there's a possibility that 13 to the east here will also flood. And so we're looking at options with the locals to potentially dike that area. But this is one of those areas where I think the height might just get too high. And it's an awful long area. And we're just watching that. We're working out different options. And this is one of the areas where we'll need to be nimble. In terms of the Bloomington Ferry Bridge itself, we recognize that becomes a key corridor and gets a lot of use during these closures due to flooding. And so we are looking, and in fact we have planned and will restripe that bridge to a three-lane section as soon as Trunk Highway 41 and 101 flood. We're going to create an additional lane of traffic to get as much traffic over that bridge as possible, and we're looking at that costing in the neighborhood of $500,000. What we're going to do is reach into the shoulder area and create overall 11-foot lanes. This is much more typical with a construction zone than it is a regular roadway, but we think the value of that third lane will be really important because of the closures.
Senator Cruz, did you have a question?
Yeah, just a real quick question. Mr. Arsenault, how quickly can that restriping be done?
Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, I'll talk about that in just a minute, and then if you have additional questions, we can cover them then. We're also going to, because of the geometric constraints with the narrower lanes, we are going to set up an advisory speed out there of 55 miles an hour to just help manage traffic. We're going to modify some signals up at 494 and prevent left turns, make that more of a through lane, just to get as much traffic through here as possible. We're trying to reduce the conflict points so we can get the maximum flow. There will be some inconveniences, but I guess that's the nature of the flooding. The ramp, for example, the ramp from Old Shakopee Road to northbound 169, due to geometric constraints, will be closed, but there's a couple of options just to the north of Old Shakopee Road. Signals at Pioneer Trail and Anderson Lake Parkway will be modified. Those are off points for the traffic that is using 169 to bypass, so we want to make sure that we're not creating unreasonable queues in those areas. We're also going to utilize our regional transportation management center and the traffic management systems that we have in place with that to help manage traffic along this corridor. We're going to increase our first freeway incident response team, our formerly highway helper coverage in this area. With the reduction of those shoulders, it's important that we quickly react to any incidents that might occur along that corridor. We believe we can do that. We'll institute some ITS technology out there, that's intelligent transportation systems, so that we can monitor it better. We'll use changeable message signs to provide as much information as possible. In terms of the striping itself, we really need to try and get that done on a weekend. So we will be watching this really close. So we're probably looking at not more than a couple weekends out here because we want to minimize the impact to traffic. And we're going to do that, again, just prior to when we believe that flood will occur, topping of 101 and 41 will occur. We believe this will have a really significant benefit. So there is going to be some additional work, but we believe we can get that done over a weekend. This is a layout of Trunk Highway 35W. This is an area that we all, I think, are aware of the important nature of 35W carrying traffic into the metro area and out. This is an area we're watching closely. We do believe we can manage through diking this area to prevent any closure. We'll watch it. There's a levee gate that we're watching closely. We may need to dike both sides. Right now, I think we're trying to keep to one side, but we'll do what's necessary to maintain this roadway. The Stillwater Lift Bridge, we're anticipating closing that bridge. We believe that the water levels are going to rise and impact the ability to keep that open. We do also think that because of the warm weather on the south, this is probably one of the first areas we're going to see impacted. We raised that bridge about 8 feet, the lift portion of the bridge, get some electrical components out of the possibility of getting water bouncing off it. We used some old Jersey barriers to ballast that bridge. This is all worked out through history and our technical experts to do what's needed to preserve that bridge and maintain it. There's an extensive diking that occurs along the river at Stillwater. Once this bridge closes, we'll close that gap over Trunk Highway 95 and the bridge access on the west side. So we believe we're positioned well to handle this closure. We, as you all know, we're in the process of constructing the Trunk Highway 61 Hastings Bridge. We do anticipate that that bridge will remain open during the floods. Because of the construction, there will be some temporary non-rush hour lane closures. Those are scheduled. Those are part of the construction. If we see that there's an impact because of the flooding for whatever reason, we'll work with the contractor to make sure that those closures don't occur.
Senator Howe?
Mr. Chair, could you back up to the Stillwater Bridge, Lift Bridge? Can you tell me how many times we've had to close that bridge in recent history?
Mr. Arsenal?
I know that it's been closed for other reasons, too, but just maybe if you could decipher between flooding and just closed for other reasons, for structural reasons. I know there's times where semis hit the bridge, too, but it'd just be interesting to know that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Howe, I personally don't have that information right now. I would bet that no one here is prepared to with that, but we can certainly get that for you.
Thank you.
Let's see. Okay, continuing then, talked earlier about scour. This is the effect of the river flow bouncing against and around our piers. It takes some of the earth with it. And so what we're doing is we utilize riprap. Riprap is big rocks that we drop around these areas, and they use up the energy of the flow before it gets to either the pier or the surrounding earth around these piers. So we add this riprap to those especially that have had a scour history. We also, again, scan the river bottoms, so we know exactly what it looks like under there, and we monitor them very closely for any change because of the flow. We also have a really interesting way of identifying when the scour begins to occur in any dramatic way, and that is we put detection buoys within the riprap underneath the water, and as the water hits that riprap, if it begins to deteriorate the riprap, these buoys will float up, send an email message to the project staff, and we'll know that something serious is happening out there, and we'll go out to take appropriate action. We'll be and look at it much closer.
Senator Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Arsenault, do you leave the riprap in place following the flood, or does it just, or what happens to it?
Mr. Arsenault.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rust, I believe that we remove it afterwards, but I'm going to defer to our structural experts. Do we have any yet? We leave it? Mr. Chair and Senator Rust, I was corrected. We leave it in
have
place.
Have to leave it, yeah.
Yep.
Mr. Arsenal.
Mr. Chair and members, we also have tilt sensors that will be monitored on the bridge. Again, watching, we're just trying to know exactly what's being caused by these floods and make sure that we're in a position to react quickly if anything happens. After the flood, we will leave the riprap in place and and rescan the bottom so that we can see how it compares to the pre-flood. If scour has occurred, we'll even add additional riprap. The contractor will then get back in there and be able to begin or resume construction of the bridge. And we also anticipate certainly that there will be some cleanup required. Again,
Senator Lewis.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Arsenault, if you could back up to the last slide. So this slide describes some of the post-flood activities that you have with the Hastings Bridge. Are there similar activities post-flood with other bridges, Stillwater Bridge in particular, but are other bridges that may be impacted by flood activity?
Mr. Arsenault?
Mr. Chair and Senator Lilly, yes, absolutely. We look at them before and we look at them after. Really the same types of activities, and this is intended to be an example of how we do that. This happens to be under construction, but it's the same kind of scenario that we would follow on all our bridges.
Thank you.
The Lafayette Bridge is also under construction right now, just the beginning of that construction. We are going to have to slow that somewhat, although we believe that construction in some areas will be able to continue throughout the flooding. On the west side of the bridge, south side of the river. There's some equipment and material that'll have to be moved. They're moving barges downriver and tying them up. We have a field office that's located in an area that is likely to be flooded. We'll either move that or we'll protect that. They're in the process of building a cofferdam. We'll have to stop that during the flooding and resume that after the flood. So some work will continue in areas where flooding is not likely to occur, down by Concord, Eaton, and Plato.
Senator Stephen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, sir, from the Hastings Bridge, everything I've heard is there shouldn't be any significant or any delay on the Hastings Bridge, however, because of the flooding. Is that still your understanding?
Mr. Arson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, that is my understanding.
Just checking. Thank you.
So we've kind of gone through some detail in a couple of locations, so I'd just talk about some of the other ones that we're watching very closely. Trunk Highway 95 along Bayport does have flooding potential, and so we're watching that. Trunk Highway 10 at Prescott, 494 Hardman Avenue ramps. We're working, and now I want to shift now to Greater Minnesota and some of the areas we're looking at in Greater Minnesota, because there's a lot going on across the state. We're working with cities and the Army Corps of Engineers building dikes along the Red River Valley locations. On some of these roadways, we actually plug culverts and manholes, and that's to protect against damage on the road. Sometimes it's used to create a dike, have the highway create a dike itself. So there's multiple things that we can do out there using our existing infrastructure. We also have pumping systems going on, managing the water flow. This is an image of the Fargo-Moorhead area, and you can see the two main bridges, 94 and 10, across there. We're looking at those bridges and their vulnerability. What are the options if we did have any issues in terms of any kind of bridge impacts along there? Some of the things that we're prepared to do is actually begin a detour in Wisconsin, detouring folks that are going through Minnesota down maybe all the way out west to go down, use I-90 instead of 94. So that can help deter some of that traffic. Highway 1 in District 2, we're preparing some inslopes prior to the flooding to prevent damage. Again, this is probably consists of riprap, but that moving water is really potentially can cause some real problems along our roadways. Other locations that are being monitored, you can see here. I won't go through them, but there's multiple locations along the Red River Valley that we historically have seen issues with and are prepared to go out and act in our staff and our forces are out there working right now. Some more locations, Highway 1 at Oslo, got a lot of attention last time. East Grand Forks. There's also a location along the Mississippi down in Lake City. This is unusual for this area to flood, but we are expecting that it's a real possibility. If we do overtop Trunk Highway 61 there, it will create a pretty negative impact. We'll have to look at detouring. There's not a good trunk highway detour there. We're going to work closely with we are working closely with the locals to try and identify appropriate detours. Trunk Highway 212 in the Montevideo and Granite Falls area, the Minnesota River comes up really close to the highway along there, and we're going to look at putting up some dikes to both protect the roadway and also to keep it open. Highway 59 in Otter Tail County, this is a perennial issue, and in fact, it is the first of our projects from our flood mitigation program that I'll talk about in just a second. We had a solicitation here just in January, but prior to even submitting that solicitation, we recognize this as a clear project that should be done out of the flood mitigation program. So what we're doing is we're pumping water from Sand Lake, providing a permanent force main to get that water to a downstream lake with a natural outlet. If there was the flood over 59 in this area, we've got a pretty very significant 31-mile detour. So we have already signed an emergency order to get out there and get working on this to minimize the impact in that area and get that project underway. Southwest Minnesota, Highway 99, St. Peter, 22 south of St. Peter, 169. These are areas, Henderson, I think you've heard about in the past. We're looking at doing whatever we can, including using sandbags, using Jersey Barrier, other types of diking systems to keep as many of these open for as long as we can keep them open. Next, I'd like to share with you something that really we get to thank the commissioner and his foresight and vision for really pushing last year. There's a real level of frustration by a lot of our folks that when these flooding conditions occur and the damage that results from them we're left to deal with, we have to replace as is through these federal programs. We can't improve them and prevent them in the future because for whatever reason, we can't do that. We have to replace it in the form that it was pre-flood. And so what we did is we set aside $50 million in existing bond authorizations to create a program that was intended to provide mitigation solutions or solutions to prevent future floods. That Trunk Highway 59 example I just shared was one of the projects that came out of this program. So in January of this year, we put out a solicitation offering $25 million of the $50 million we had available for these types of projects. These are ones that can be delivered quickly and also ones that maybe are a little longer term because this is funding that's provided over 5 years as shown on this slide. And what we found, the solicitation was in January. We had intended to provide about $25 million in projects funding out there. We actually looks like, although we're not, this isn't complete yet, it looks like we're around the $20 million range. This fall, then, we will be putting out the second solicitation to offer the remainder of that $50 million. We believe this is really going to help us in the long run. These are sustainable solutions. We've got a sustainability umbrella across MnDOT. We're trying to think about context-sensitive and sustainable solutions. This is one way for us to do that. And we're fortunate that we took the initiative to do this last year. I think I covered much of this. We want to reduce the impact on safety and mobility of future floods. Also, we can match some of those emergency funding to enhance the otherwise solution that would bring it back to pre-flood.
Senator Hull?
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, I want to go back to some of the highway crossings. You don't need to go back in your overview, though, because it's not on there. I'm just wondering if maybe Mr. Fried or you could talk about the U.S. Highway 61 or 63 crossing, U.S. Highway 63 crossing there, and if there's any thoughts of what would transpire there, if there's any potential talk of doing a ferrying operation or what's our consideration. I know it's on the Wisconsin side, but have we reached out to the Wisconsin DOT or anybody on that issue?
Mr. Arsenal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Howe, we have a telephone conference on Monday with Wisconsin to discuss that bridge.
Okay. Thank you. If you would, Mr. Chair, if I could just be updated on that, I'd appreciate that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Howe, we will certainly do that after that conference. I think that I've covered most of this relative to the flood mitigation bonding. Again, it's just intended to mitigate the impacts of these floods so that we can minimize the impact on the citizens of this state. And with that, I would offer ourselves for any questions that you may have.
Any additional questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Arsenault. Mr. Free, appreciate your update on what you're working on for flood mitigation. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you.
We also have a couple of county engineers, one from Carver County and one from Clay County, with us here today, and we'd like to invite them to the table to talk about the county perspective a little bit here.
Sure, I do have a handout if I could hand it around.
Certainly. We can get Bob to pass that out for you. Welcome to the committee, and if you would state your name for the record.
Sure.
Lyndon Robjent, Public Works Director, Carver County.
Dave Overbow, Clay County Engineer in Morehead.
Bear with me, Mr. Chair, for a second. See if I can transfer.
Maybe while Lyndon's working on the computer a little bit, I'll just give a little bit of information on some of the things that are going on in our area, in our district. Clay County is in District 4. There's 12 counties in our district. one of the things I'd like to talk about a little bit would be proposed funding for the Local Road Improvement Program. Some of the things that would be very beneficial to some of the counties in our area would be possibly some additional funding for flood mitigation efforts, similar to what Mr. Arsenault was talking about. A lot of the counties in our area are also dealing with some of the closed basin flooding, some of the repetitive overland flooding that we see year after year, culverts that are maybe undersized or just not correctly armored to handle the high waters that we're currently seeing. Some of the projects that I guess in discussing this issue with our other neighboring counties are possibly there's some road raises that could be done that are not programmed or not funded or not able to be done with our current level of funding that we have now. We've got some in-slope armoring things, utilizing riprap, I guess similar to some of the projects that we see that MnDOT's talking about as well. This armoring would eliminate washouts and the road being completely taken out by this overland flooding, things that you don't see in normal times of the year with normal precipitation, but in the springtime with the heavy flooding, the ditches that get filled up with ice and then they build up and then overland flooding takes off.
Mr. Overbow, could you give us some of the major, where is Clay County and some of the major cities?
Sure, yeah, Clay County is right adjacent to the city of Fargo, Morehead is the county seat. We are about 60 miles northwest of Fergus Falls, right alongside the Red River, obviously. This will be potentially our third year of devastating floods. 2009, we reached records that exceeded the 1997 level when we had over 100 inches of snow that year.
Okay, thank you for that. That's where the river flows to the north.
That's correct, so yep.
Creates additional challenges. Appreciate that. Yeah.
Any additional funding, I guess, that we could see for the improvement program would be beneficial. Most of our funding levels have been, spent up fighting over the wintertime, all the heavy snow plowing that we've been doing. It's almost been every weekend since the middle of December, and our resources are pretty well tapped out in there, as well as some of the other things that wouldn't be program related would be just pumping. A lot of times we're out there pumping these closed basins down, and they wouldn't really be more of an improvement program type of a project, but it still costs a lot of money in doing things like that. I guess I just wanted to pass on our need and our willingness for putting together projects quickly and saving money down the road. Any mitigative efforts we can do would be greatly appreciated.
Well, thank you. Any questions from the committee? A lot of eyes in the Minnesota Senate and House, and I know in the governor's office too, are focused your direction and. We'll be watching carefully and how we can be helpful. So, Mr. Robjent.
Mr. Chair, Lyndon Robjent, County Engineer, Carver County. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak to you today. I was asked to give a little background about the 2010 floods, specifically in my county, Carver County, and Scott County, southwest area of the Twin Cities Metro. As you know, we had two significant flood events in 2010. which caused major problems for us in the metropolitan area. One in the spring due to the snow melt last winter, March and April. And then again, we had a fall event in September, October due to heavy rains. What this did is it had a severe trunk highway and county road impact. It was a regional problem as well as a local one for us. Some perspective on the Minnesota River. In our area, there's 7 river crossings from 169 to Trunk Highway 19. That would be south part of Hennepin County, Carver Scott County, Sibley Counties. That represents probably about 115,000 trips per day for the Southwest Metro. And during those events, only 2 of those river crossings were open. Trunk Highway 169, MnDOT talked about that a little bit, and 25, which they also talked about. So what this resulted in is about a 50,000 vehicle per day detour. And we estimate that's about 20,000 commuters that were impacted by these events. So again, this is not only a local problem, but it's definitely a regional issue. If you look at the math for benefit cost ratio based on traffic impacts and detours, we're estimating around $2 million a day in the economic impact just on those detours. The extra travel that commuters, truck drivers, and goods movers have to expend. With that, there's also emergency response time is severely compromised when you've got limited options to get across the river. Between us and Scott County, specifically, we only had 1 river crossing open, and that was Trunk Highway 25. And that was, believe me, the water was lapping at the edges of the road there. We've heard this year it could be worse. It's coming. We've got a little flavor of that. What I've heard is actually maybe worse. Maybe it's because it's upstream. I've heard 40% chance that we could reach 1965 flood levels. Before Bernie mentioned the 25 diking, that would mean all river crossings would be closed between Scott and Carver County. What we try to do is keep track of how long our roads are closed from flood to flood, and this gives you a small flavor, at least in Carver County, of what we're up against. We have 2 major issues. One's the Minnesota River, which is very, very significant traffic-wise, and then the Crow River, which is more rural, the more rural part of the county. That's not as great an economic or traveler impact, but it's still significant from a local perspective. So as you can see from these dots, the bigger the dot, the longer the road was closed. A reference point in the very easterly part of the county, that's Trunk Highway 101. Actually, the Scott County side of 101 is actually a county road. And the north part, the Carver County, is currently a trunk highway. But it is on MnDOT's turn back list to be a county road. So we have a tremendous vested interest in that highway. As you can see in the spring flood, that was closed for 28 days. Now, again, this is a major problem for us between Shakopee, Chanhassen, and Chaska. There's a significant amount of traffic, 22,000 vehicles a day that cross at that location. I can't think of too many metropolitan cities that have river crossings that are impacted this way by flooding. 41, which is in Chaska, again, the closure was around 23 days for that one. So you can imagine the problem. The fall flood was a little different. It was a rain event that caused it more than snow melt. The levels were actually higher in this event, but they also dissipated faster. So again, 101 was closed about 15 days, and 41 in Chaska around 10 days. Going up to the north part of the county in the city of Watertown, we have closures up there that impact that city tremendously. This year, we're really concerned about a county road that crosses the Crow River, County Road 10. It's the only river crossing from one side of Watertown to the other. And there's schools on each side of the road. Half the city is basically each side of the river. That bridge was not closed last in 2010. However, with the recent predictions, we're thinking that it would have to be. And so we're working with MnDOT to try to put diking on 25, which would be a detour route. Without that, just to get back and forth to school would be a 19-mile detour. Unfortunately, the bridge that crosses the river there is structurally deficient also, and it's also on the National Historic Register. So, you know, replacing the structure is difficult. We are at this time doing a study to provide a second crossing of the Crow River south of town. And so any assistance you can give us with that would be greatly appreciated. This graphic, again, is in draft form. MnDOT talked about that the flood bonding or the flood mitigation money, the $50 million that they programmed for flood projects. They have stepped up greatly on this in this particular area, and we're doing a study on the 101, 41, and 169 corridors. Those, again, are the high traffic, the biggest traffic generators. And we're working with a consultant, SEH, to prepare some benefit cost studies on what could be done with those crossings. What this tries to show, it's a lot of lines and color, but it tries to show what the impact of the closures are for 101. The green is the width of the line represents the amount of traffic that crosses that corridor. So it gives you a sense the wider the line, the more demand there is on that corridor. So as you can see, in a normal condition, these are all open and majority of traffic, these thick lines represent what occur there. With those closed, all three closed, again, two of those, 101 and 41, are MnDOT roads, although, again, part of 101 is a county road. The part down here is County Road 11 to the south that goes to Jordan. That is a county highway. All those get closed, and the red line represents the detoured traffic, the significance of what those commuters and what those commerce folks have to deal with to get around the flood. In a general scenario, those red lines at 169 would be more like this thickness traffic-wise. So it's a significant disruption. Just some pictures here. They speak a thousand words of what we deal with every year when these floods happen. This is Scott County Road 1 near Blakely. As you can see, quite an impact. Second shot of that. County Road 51 near the bluffs. Again, this is more backwaters of the river that caused the closure here. Scott County Road 9. This is either side of the Minnesota River Bridge. It's County Road 9 on the south side. On the north side, it's our County Road 11. That went under last year. This shot here is our County Road 11. You can't even see the road. The road snakes around here, goes up the hill, and daylights again up here. So this is a significant impact. The bridge obviously is intact, although we did see significant damage due to scour under this structure that we are repairing right now. This scour hole is about 15 feet deep, and we had significant erosion along the banks of the north bank of the river. So this is the riprap that Bernie was talking about. That we do the same thing, very large diameter rock, to mitigate, to prepare us for the next event. We do not take those away. This was about $250,000 project. Fortunately, during the last special session, if you remember, we were fortunate enough to get $10 million in bonding for flood repair. We were able to use about $150,000 for this project, so I thank you for that. That's a great help. Some pictures again. This is our County Road 11 to Jordan. There is a traffic sign here if you look closely. Right there, there's about 7 feet to the top, to the where the sign starts. So you can see the road was about 6 feet underwater. A shot of downtown Carver. This has been in the news recently due to their levee and their threat of floods. They are right now 24/7 trucking in material to raise their levee in town by 4 feet at a cost of about $500,000. This shot represents the significant logjam that occurs on the Minnesota River every year due to this railroad bridge here. This is a United Pacific Railroad bridge. The county is in negotiations with the railroad actually right now. Both counties are to acquire this railroad corridor. It's an abandoned line, so the railroad's going through the abandonment process, but we're trying to acquire that. The railroad will be responsible for removing that structure. It's a chronic issue every year, as you can see by the amount of logs that get jammed at the structure. They did work this winter. We talked to them many, many times, as did the city. They were very proactive about getting the railroad to come out here and release this log jam prior to the flood, while the waters are still low. So they had some equipment out there, and they were excavating this and pushing it downstream. So hopefully it won't impact the flood too badly this spring. Still a pretty dramatic situation. 101, this is Scott County 101. Again, the south part of 101 is a county road. It shows the flooding. The bridge is obviously high and dry, relatively new structure. But what we need to do is we need help. We need help on getting this situation fixed. This is 101. You can't see the road. This is the bridge towards the Carver County side. That also goes under in extreme events. But obviously there's almost a mile of flooding across that roadway. Some history. Again, we're in the early stages of doing the studies on these roads to figure out high benefit, lower cost strategies to fix the problem. And part of this is just some research that the consultant did to show the history of flooding in the area. And as you can see, in the last few years, the two 2010 ones were pretty bad. The yellow, the green line, if you can see that on the maps, is when the road closes. So it seems like in the last couple decades, we've had a significant amount of closures. What this also shows, which is quite interesting, is the amount of fill, or the amount we'd have to raise the road to get it out of the problem area, between 6 and 10 feet. Again, a technical drawing here that shows the cross section longitudinal profile along 101. Again, the problem is about 0.9 miles where the road's too low. Over 20,000 vehicles a day use this roadway. We've got to come up with a solution here. The solutions we're studying, of course, being in the river basin, there's a lot of environmental constraints we have to deal with. Bottom line is we've got to increase the opening of the river. You can't just raise the roadway because that's not allowed. You can't increase the stage of the flow. Obviously, that affects upstream flooding as well as the environment. So we're looking at some options to do this with the study. Hopefully, we'll be ready in time for the next round of the solicitation that MnDOT referred to the $50 million that's programmed for flood relief. Again, 41's a similar situation. 41's a little bit of a higher road. It's about 18,000 vehicles a day. I think I showed 20,000 on here. It's still a very significant arterial corridor between the two counties. Shots just showing what happened last year. Again, similar process, lots of history and on flooding. And this one, the raising the road, adding new structure, wouldn't be as high as it would be on 101. This goes under later than 101 does. Same sort of situation, a profile here that shows the low spot. It's about 0.7 miles we're dealing with here. So what can be done? Again, develop some high and fund some high benefit cost flood-proof projects. We're going through that on the Minnesota River. This can be something that done statewide, however. Use these mitigation bonds or program funds that MnDOT has set aside. Likely those won't be enough, so we're asking for help there. Just a rough estimate on a 101 bridge, if we built a two-lane structure, really should be a four-laner, got it out of the river that for a 100-year event, we're looking at a minimum of $25 million to do a simple land bridge across that floodplain. So that'll eat up that $50 million budget pretty fast, considering the $20 million I think has already been spoken for. So we've got to figure out some good solutions there. That's just one of the crossings, whether 101 or 41 or adding another lane on 169 is appropriate. We're looking at all of that. From the county perspective, Again, we have a vested interest in 101 because it will be our road someday, but we've got our own issues. We're really hoping that the local road improvement program that Dave talked about gets funded this time. We've got a proposal out there for $100 million. Part of that's in three categories, but the routes of regional significance could include flood mitigation projects to help out with these floods long term. And another plug for the local bridge bond program. That's been very successful for us. As you know, it pays for half of the bridge replacements on county highways, and it's been very, very successful helping us replace some of our bridges. We're asking for $50 million this time around, and that could also be used to mitigate some of these flood problems. That's all I had, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Senator Gazalka.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm just wondering where you're from.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I'm England. I'm originally from England. Actually had the honor to become a U.S. citizen last week.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
That was very, very good for me and my family, sir.
Good. Well, thank you for your testimony about flooding in
Mr.
your
Chair.
Senator Sanjum?
Mr. Chair, and I didn't get your name, but to the Carver County, on the special session bonding bill last year, you referred to the $10 million and using $150,000 for scouring and so on. Is there some additional money left there that can be useful, you know, going forward, looking at this year?
Mr. Robjent?
Mr. Chair, Senator, well, I'd have to defer to MnDOT,
okay,
State Aid Office on that, but we can get back to you. Okay. I believe there was quite a high demand for the funds, so I'm not sure if there's any left, but I would imagine that if this flood is anything like the last one, we'd probably be asking for additional help there too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. The second item on our agenda is Senate File 132, Senator Fischbach. Senator Fischbach, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm honored to be here. I haven't gotten to appear in front of your committee this year yet, so I'm very happy to be here. And I appreciate that you juggled your schedule a little bit to accommodate my schedule with another bill up in another committee. Senate File 132 basically allows the city of Painesville to keep money that they were granted when they acquired, or in order to acquire some land for their airport, and there's some dollars that are left in that fund, and they would like to be able to hang on to that for future purchases of land. And I believe it's by June 30th, 2015, that if they don't spend all the money by then, it would be returned to the state under the current bill. But I do have with me Ron Mergen from the city, and my God,
First family.
Thank you so much. I know these people. I just went completely blank. And Bert Stanley, from the Airport Commission, with me today, who would be able to provide more testimony and answer questions.
Okay. Well, welcome to the committee. And if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Bert Stanley. I'm Chairman of the Painesville Airport Commission. Thank you for taking time to hear us. What we're looking for is in 2002, with the cooperation of the State Aeronautics at a 60-40, we bought land for a new airport, have developed the airport, and now in 2008 and 2009, Trunk Highway 23 is going around Painesville in a four-lane, and it took 8.05 acres of our airport property. So we don't have land for future T-hangers. We just completed one last year, so we won't complete one for a few years. But we do need land, and there is land to the northwest of us that we could negotiate with and hopefully purchase. With the sale of the land to MnDOT DOT, we have $57,045, which is the state's 60% portion to aeronautics that they would like back. We would like to keep that earmarked for purchase of land as the state's portion, aeronautics portion. So it's a trade-off of land for land. And we just want to keep that money in our dedicated fund for that so we don't have to stand in a be prioritized again for land, which we've already been prioritized for once.
Any questions? Senator Rust.
Thank you, Senator Fischbach, Mr. Chairman. How unusual is this kind of request? Do you know, or is there somebody here from MnDOT that could respond to that? I mean, I'd be just curious if this has, we've had similar requests in the past from other people that use the State Airports Fund, get a grant from it, and then want to keep the money if they haven't done the project.
Mr. Roy.
Chairman, Senator, to my knowledge, there's been two requests, this being the second one. The first one was Wilmer. Wilmer's request came through several years ago, probably on the order of about 4 or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Outside of that, everything else that I'm aware of has been worked out through the terms of the agreement that were in the initial grant or contained within the statutes. So as property was being used for other purposes, that money would be returned back to the airport fund.
And so, Mr. Chairman, the general practice is that the money does go back to the State Airports Fund?
Mr. Roy?
That is correct, but even at that, it's a pretty rare occurrence that land that was used, that was acquired with airport fund money to be sold, and it just doesn't happen very often.
Mr. Senator Chairman Rust. And Senator Fischbach, or gentlemen, and what's the dollar amount again? You maybe said that, and I just didn't pick up on it.
Mr. Stanley,
The dollar amount is $57,045. Not a big number.
Okay.
And do I understand this correctly? It was MnDOT Aviation,
yes,
that originally helped to pay for this land, and now it's MnDOT Highway that has purchased the land for.
That is correct.
And they want you to pay back the $57,000, which was a portion of their portion of that 8 acres. MnDOT Aviation wants that.
Mr. Chairman, the money that would be paid back would go back to the aeronautics division into their fund, mm-hmm. and we're asking to, and then when we buy some more land, we'd have to go and prioritize with the aeronautics again to get another project that would be at their priority level to get it back. And we need, just swapping land is really what we need to do.
Mr. Roy, is there some statutory problem with doing this, or is it seems like it wouldn't be that big of a deal to move from MnDOT one area to MnDOT in another area? Is there a problem here that this hasn't been completed or hasn't been able to be worked out?
Yes, Mr. Chair, there's actually two conflicting problems. The first one is in state statute. It's state statute 360.35. Looks like subdivision 4, letter G, subpart 2, I think is how it would go. And what it amounts to is money that is granted to an airport for land purposes needs to be maintained and utilized for aeronautical purposes for 99 years. If it is not done that way, then when the airport would sell the land, that money needs to be repaid at a prorated amount as per back to the original aeronautical participation in the acquisition of the land back to the airport fund. So in state statute, it does require that in this situation where property was bought, that it be referred back to the airport fund. Furthermore, in 2002, when MnDOT Aeronautics granted the land to the city of Painesville for the acquisition of the land, the city approved and signed a legally binding grant agreement with the state of Minnesota in the airport's fund. One of the clauses in that grant states the exact same thing. When the property is no longer used for aeronautical purposes, the fair market value of the land sold needs to be returned to the state's airport fund.
Ms. Berzovsky, yeah, I see you have the good book open. Do you have anything else to add to that?
Mr. Chair, no, I think that that was accurately represented.
Thank you, Ms. Berzovsky. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does the department support this request?
Mr. Roy.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the department has concerns over this request. And why we have the concerns is the way we read it, not only the statute, but also the legally binding agreement, the money is owed back to the airport's fund. That money then can be utilized at other airports, and it's going to a dedicated fund that would go towards airports, and it could be used at every airport or any airport across the entire state during this time, at which time the city of Painesville is ready to acquire additional lands. They would submit a request back to the Office of Aeronautics where their request would be prioritized against whatever funds were available in the airport fund at that time, and they would receive funding for the acquisition of the property. The request of $57,000 being returned is actually only the land value of the property. In addition to that, Trunk Highway MnDOT compensated the airport, the city, for not only the direct land purchases, but also severances, damages to the city. And really what it amounts to is the additional burden placed on the city to find additional property or looking at comparison properties around the airport in order to utilize that. We are not asking for any of those damages to be returned to us. It is only the property value that we're asking to be returned, and I believe that that's the correct application of the law, but also what was in the agreement.
Senator Russ.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Was the Wilmer situation similar? I'm trying to recall that. I'm a person who's very jealous about the state airports fund.
Mr. Roy?
Chair and Senator, Wilmer is similar in many ways in that Wilmer's situation was that they had an old airport and there was money used from the state airport fund to acquire land for the Wilmer old airport. They opened up a new airport, and as soon as they opened up that new airport, the old airport was no longer being used for aviation purposes, and that money was due back to the airport fund. However, what has happened is the FAA has stepped in and has not allowed a land release for Wilmer to sell that property. So Wilmer owes the state airport fund money, but they have no money because they have not sold the land. They have not been paid for that land yet to repay the airport fund. And that is my understanding, the primary reason why the bill and eventually the law for Wilmer was passed. In the case of Painesville, the difference being that Painesville has been paid the money due them for the land, and in fact they've been paid late 2009 that money. So there are some differences between Wilmer and Painesville, but there also are some similarities.
Senator Hall?
Mr. Chair, I'm just looking at here. It looks like, so the severance damage was a little over $70,000, correct? Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the deal. So it was $70,200. And if you subtract the $57,000 from the $95,000, you would add that to the $70,000 to calculate what the city was paid, correct?
Mr. Roy. I think what he's referring, of course, to your letter back to Mayor Jeff Thompson, and I believe paragraph 4, where he's talking about the $70,000 severance damages. Mr. Roy?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I believe that that's correct for this portion of the property that was in the airport. I believe the actual payment to the city was larger because there was some other properties associated with that. But what you're interpreting for the property in question is exactly
for the airport.
Right.
Okay.
Was that the damages was the $70,000, and then the acquisition of the property was a total of $95,000. And $57,000 of that would be the prorated amount of the initial contribution of the airport fund towards the property acquisition back in 2002.
Now, Mr. Chair, so it sounds like these contracts, everything has already been signed and everything's been done on this. We're just trying to kind of correct this after the fact. I was just wondering, do you ever, you know, like if you took 8.5 acres from the airport land, work out a deal where, you know, obviously the airport said there's land to the north where you'd just trade acre for acre rather than getting into the dollar exchange?
Mr. Roy? Or actually maybe one of the city guys could respond to that.
Chair and Senator, it is the practice of MnDOT, not only in MnDOT Aeronautics but also on the highway side, to compensate people for the loss of property and compensate them for that, and then let them go and determine what is best and where to find the additional properties. Occasionally, there is a means for which you could do a land exchange. It is a process that's been defined by law. To my knowledge, I don't believe the aeronautics has gotten involved in any of those, certainly in the recent past. And maybe the city could add a little bit more to that.
Yes, I'm the airport manager, Ron Mergen. And, you know, I believe we had looked into that, trying to do a land swap. But when we got into the MnDOT roads, it was not allowed because the money had to be an actual transfer, is I believe what we were told. But yes, I agree 100% with that, Senator, that that would have been a good idea. And we would have went along with that.
Senator Dillon.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions. One is just kind of wondering the kind of the tone of this, or you know, kind of the dynamic around this transaction. When this property was acquired for Trunk Highway 23, was the airport kind of given no choice? I mean, it had to happen. I assume there's a benefit of this roadway to the airport itself. That's my first question. Second question, somewhat related. Thinking about a larger policy idea, which is rather than getting into this money, you know, kind of trying to take this money back for the purpose of acquiring land. When this occurs with respect to airports, is it possible as a matter, you know, put the money back in so everything's clean, but then allow that particular airport that's had a bit of its land carved off, first take on the next, you know, on acquiring
the next round of grants.
Yeah. I mean, I understand why MnDOT wants to keep this whole transaction clean because of the precedential nature of operating like this. Put the money back in, but then allow Painesville Airport to come to the top of the priority pile rather than all of a sudden compete again for land that it clearly needs for hangars and things like that. So that's a policy question maybe put to the committee, or maybe MnDOT could respond. But I'm also wondering, what is the perspective of Painesville? I mean, do they kind of not have a choice? This was going to happen, and we had to cut this deal with MnDOT?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, on your first question there, in 2002, the city embraced the Highway 23 rerouting. I don't know if you're familiar with Painesville, but we were a bottleneck on that highway. So I know our mayor had gone to Washington to solicit funds for that rerouting several times, which you obviously participated in that, and we do appreciate that. And again, I guess I'd just like to reiterate that, you know, we don't want to have to stand in line again to get the $57,000 for the reauthorization of land.
So in terms of the, to MnDOT, the policy question, keep it clean. You sold the airport, sold the land back to you, got the money, it's in the airport fund, but let them have the first take out of the fund rather than running back on the back on an even playing field and competing for those dollars for future expansion needs. It's an idea. It's a bad idea, a good idea.
Mr. Roy?
Chair and Senator, generally speaking, how our priority system works is safety projects would rise to the top. And then you're kind of into a wide variety of projects that would kind of be the second tier of projects. Some of them might be preservation sorts of projects, but others of them would be land acquisition like this. And I think given the circumstances of what's happening at Painesville, we could certainly consider it to be a higher priority in that second tier, but I think we still ought to reserve the first dollars to be for those safety projects. Keep in mind, on an annual basis, our airport construction budget is somewhere in the neighborhood of about $8 million. It is a very unusual year that we would have anywhere near that amount of safety dollars asked of us from that account. So almost undoubtedly we'll be into that second tier and maybe even coming very close to fully funding those second tier projects. The other thing to make mention is whenever the city of Painesville is ready to acquire this property, their submittal back to the airport fund would be for 60% or 70%, depending upon if they're a federally funded airport or not, of the entire purchase price of the land. So it could be in excess of this $57,000, ultimately could be what they're asking for. So they would potentially benefit by actually waiting and asking and being in line as well.
Sounds like a good deal for Painesville, potentially, depending upon the purchase price of the property that they want to replace it. But any other questions? Senator Gazelka?
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 132 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Transportation Finance Bill.
Mr. Chair, and I appreciate, thank you for the, Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, thank you for the motion. I just wanted to say just a little something, if that was okay. I didn't want you to just go by.
We weren't going to put on the hammer, Senator Fischbach.
I just wanted to remind the committee, Mr. Chair, that we're talking about $57,000, and really, there's an expiration date on this. The city, June 30th, 2015. Either they have to spend it on that airport construction or the acquisition of land, or they have to return it. So we're talking about a short period of time that they would have this available to them. They're not asking to have some exception to, do something completely different with it. They want to spend it on the airport. They just want to be able to hang on to it for that 4 years as something comes up because they've had that unusual circumstance of the highway coming through and so close to the airport that they had to give up part of their airport. So I think that it is, yes, there may be some precedent set in it, but it is not as bad as I think it would, as it could be. They're not asking to take it, spend something else, just hang on to it for a couple of years until they figure out how they want to deal with the airport. So thank you very much, and I appreciate your motion, Senator Gazelka.
And I could just testify that the city of Painesville has been a tremendous partner in that bypass around their city and making that go very smoothly. It is a huge project and will be very beneficial for traffic flow all across the western part of the state because we'll be rid of that bottleneck, and so we want to do what we can to help them, and you've been a tremendous partner in that process. So any other questions? We have a motion that Senate File 132 be approved and laid over for possible inclusion in the Senate Finance in the Transportation Finance Bill.
Mr. Any Chair, just to say, listening to the testimony and so on, and just I would offer my encouragement to you to include this in your omnibus bill.
And
to lay it over for possible inclusion in this Senate Transportation Finance Bill. Thank you, Senator Senjum. Any other discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I'm not crazy about the idea. I am interested in policy. Mm-hmm. So, I do. I, money's small, I understand. And I know we're going to keep this money for airport purposes. And so I think we can actually come up with a policy idea to maybe give some criteria, you know, to first or second tier projects in these circumstances, you know, for the dispersal of those funds. So that's what I'm interested in. So maybe we can do both.
Maybe
this exception, but create a policy that gives some direction to MnDOT in the future for these circumstances.
And I think we should probably do that while it's fresh in our minds before we have a much bigger issue like this with a lot more money. And Senator Fischbach, maybe you'd be willing to work with myself, Senator Dibble, and MnDOT to formulate a policy discussion on that and possibly some language for the policy bill coming up later in the session.
I
have to look at that.
Certainly designate Senator Rest to serve in my place.
Senator Rest, we'd appreciate your input
and,
on that.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to vote no, but with that understanding that we can work on a general policy, I don't like to see the first tier safety issues sacrificed from the airport's fund, which the legislature tends to raid every time it can. But with that understanding, I'll be pleased to vote yes.
Is Mr. Arsenal still here? Must have left. Okay. Well, I was hoping to get an off-the-record head nod from him before we did this, but we'll pursue it, definitely. So any other comments, discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
There being no other business, we stand adjourned.